We are back together on What We Watch When We Drink, our podcast on Booze Dancing Network. How are we doing tonight?
So far, so good. We're going to be better very shortly.
Why is that?
Well, we've got some things to sample. We've got some stuff to discuss. We have a special guest.
Whiskey always makes things better.
It's a wet Wednesday. Wet Wednesday. Who doesn't like wet Wednesday?
It's a wet Wednesday, yes.
How about wet Whiskey Wednesday? Can it be the three W's?
That should be a bar thing. That should be a bar thing. And I think our guest has a bar background, so we can ask him if that's a thing in bars.
How about wet T-shirt Whiskey Wednesday? Can we?
I think that's like an 80s and 90s thing. I don't think they have
now,
that.
We'll bring it back.
And now that's now old, you're going too far. You're going too far.
You and your Zima can go take that back 30 years.
All right. Well, all right. Before we get out of hand, let's roll the intro. Ready?
Do it.
Welcome to What We Watch When We Drink, a Booze Dancing Entertainment Network podcast featuring lively discussions about movies, TV shows, and anything else that we're watching while we drink our favorite boozy beverages. If you enjoy this show, please subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, Google, Audible, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. You can also find us on boozedancing.com, and if you have any questions, comments, show, or drink suggestions, email us at boozedancing@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.
We are back. What We Watch When We Drink, our podcast, is back. The unofficial podcast of Ontario, Canada. Now, a lot of people didn't know that. We are. And I bring that up because it turns out, you guys don't know this, but we are not in compliance with the National Podcast Association Canadian content rule. I didn't even know there was that rule, but we get emails.
Are you making this stuff up?
It's real. We get these emails. And it turns out that since this podcast can be streamed north of the border, we have to have a certain percentage of Canadian content. And tonight, we are going to do that in spades. We are going to get beyond the threshold, beyond belief, because we're going to be in compliance from Yellowknife to Whitehorse to Halifax, all over Canada. We aren't going to be in compliance. So no more nasty emails, NPA, okay?
How about Saskatchewan?
That's in there. It encompasses. It's in the middle.
I just wanted to say Saskatchewan.
I know you love that word.
It's a great word.
Tonight, our very special guest is the global Canadian whiskey ambassador for Corby Wine and Spirit, Dave Mitten. Why don't we bring Dave in?
Dave!
Hey guys! Thanks for having me.
Welcome. Thanks for helping us
get in compliance. Thank you so much. We have to get our Canadian content up higher.
I wasn't aware of any of that. I was listening.
Well, that makes two of us.
Yeah.
I think he made it up.
It's almost like I made it up.
You never know. Dave, how are you?
I'm great. How are you guys?
Excellent. Getting better by the minute.
Yeah. So where are you right now? Because I know you travel a lot.
I do. And I mean, the month of January has been nice. There's not been a lot of travel. I'm actually taking my first flight tomorrow down to Boston. But right now I'm at home in Toronto.
Hey, so, I remember when I saw you, you said you had you have a place there and you never are there.
I'm never here. I've got a bunch of books behind me that need to be read that are, and maybe some whiskey to be drank, but it's very rare that I am at home.
Those books make you look really smart. Yeah. Unlike us who have whiskey behind us, which makes us look really.
I got a poster.
It's just one of those fancy backgrounds. I don't actually own a book. It's just it's a photo from a friend's house.
You should throw those books away and get more whiskey.
Yeah.
That's just a waste of space,
paper,
really.
It's paper wastes all that space.
That's the other room. This is kind of the living room, and the parents come over. I'm like, oh, I need the other room is the one where friends come over where the spirits are.
Yeah, never go in that room. Don't go in there.
Dave, so you and I met in L.A., and I heard a little bit about your background. Why don't you give our audience a little bit of where you came from, what you do now for Corby, and a little bit about Corby.
Yeah, of course. So, I mean, I grew up East Coast Canada, Maritimes and New Brunswick, kind of by Maine and Vermont. After high school, spent quite a few years, I wanted to go see the world traveling, fell in love with the bar industry because that was how I had to pay my way, working at bars and restaurants around the world. Ended up in Toronto in 2001, working in the industry, and decided to lose my mind and open up my first bar, which then led to opening up a little restaurant and bar and a couple more. And basically for about 15 years, I owned and operated bars and restaurants and really focused on cocktails and cocktails with whiskey, even more so. Falling in love with many categories, but certainly our own Canadian whiskey, to where I was using select brands enough that the company, Corby Spirit and Wine, who I work for now, did approach me and asked if I wanted to help create a role on education and advocacy around the category and their brands. And it was supposed to be a year-long contract, and that was in 2014. So here I am now, almost 9 years later. I've been heading up the education and advocacy program along with Gina Fawcett, who I don't think you met. She wasn't in LA with me, but she's US-based, and she's my partner in crime. We take care of all the education on the category and brands together.
So when you say education, who are you educating?
Well, for the most part, I mean, we big focus around the US, Canada, overseas on bars and restaurants. You know, bartenders are a big one. It's that snowball effect where if the bartender falls in love with your spirit, your brand, the idea is they're going to tell their guests all about it. The guests are going to ask. Hopefully they'll go pick some up next time at the local spirit store. And I mean, obviously, we get to work with amazing people like yourselves and, you know, whiskey clubs all around the world. Like, honestly, we meet so many great people from doing that, working whiskey shows, cocktail festivals. Yeah, that's kind of, it's a handful of whiskey and cocktail geeks.
Were you a whiskey person before? I know you had bars, but were you actually a whiskey person before?
I was your bartender who loved all spirits. I was really fortunate kind of in my age bracket or time of being a bartender is when brands started flying them to their distilleries and taking them on brand trips. And fortunately for me at the time, when cocktails were coming around, I found myself really falling in love with that. And some might say trying to lead the charge and getting people in Toronto or Canada into the cocktails. So with that, I was taken to lots of different distilleries. And I mean, I was learning about rum. I was learning about mezcal. I was learning about different types of whiskeys. I will say that I did fall in love with the whiskey category more than most. And to be quite honest, I'll never forget the first time when I started this role, I got taken down to our distillery. It's an hour flight from Toronto, 4-hour drive. And when I came back, the company asked, like, what do you think? How was it? And I said, it was great. It was fantastic. I've been selling your products for 15 years. How have I never been there before? And, you know, put it simply, Canadian whiskey, I think, is one of the most misunderstood spirit categories in the world. And that is the fault of the owners of the Canadian whiskey, the brand teams. Like, we had never educated on the category before. 10 years ago, I could learn about Scotch, Irish whiskey, maybe even Japanese whiskey at the time, 10 years ago, American whiskey, all different types of categories from America, but there wasn't any education, reading material, really, on Canadian whiskey, which I got to give a shout out, Davin de Kergamo, who wrote Canadian Whiskey, The Portable Expert. That is, you know, the Canadian whiskey Bible.
It is the Bible.
That was out back then, but as far as learning anything, besides all the misconceptions, it was very tough. So the idea, it was a pretty cool challenge to take on and start creating an education program around the category and our brands.
One of the reasons you're here tonight is to educate us. So why don't you start your schooling of these three little dunces? You were kind enough to,
we're here to learn, Dave.
We're here to learn. We'll call it learning.
Research.
Right, research. Yes, it's a big research paper for us.
Yes.
You were kind enough to send us three different whiskeys from Corby, and we're going to start with the first one that you sent us, right? Which is
the J.P. Weiser's 18. I'm going to look at the bottle.
J.P. Weiser's 18. It's cool, a square bottle.
Dave, question for you.
Yeah, it's nice. People like it on the back bar.
Question for you. Corby, is that the distillery for all three of these? Or are they like the distributor, whatever you want to call it?
Corby Spirit and Wine, essentially, we are a separate company from Pernod Ricard, but half of us is owned by Pernod Ricard. We distribute all of their products here in Canada. Our distillery is owned by Pernod Ricard, and we run it, Hiram Walker & Sons Distillery. All the whiskeys that we'll taste tonight, all the whiskeys I represent are made at Hiram Walker Distillery.
Okay.
We do make a lot of other spirits and brands at that distillery, but all of ours that I look after are put out by Dr. Don Livermore, our master blender, and the whole team down there.
Okay. All right. Weisers. Let's get some pouring. This bottle is impressive, by the way.
I mean, it is. It's a nice, good, like, thick glass bottle. Like, people usually comment how much they enjoy it. I feel like I should just maybe give a little bit into, like, rules and regulations on Canadian whiskey quickly, because I think that is where a lot of misconceptions come in. It's pretty simple. We've got lots of room to be very innovative. Canadian whiskey, international law, like most whiskeys, we have to be cereal grain. We use corn, rye, wheat, and barley. We buy 100,000 metric tons of corn every year and about 10,000 metric tons of each of the other corn. So we are a pretty big facility.
Is it all Canadian grain?
It is. What we say is we buy local. So, I mean, it sounds cool, but it's also, it's good business to buy local. Ontario is about the size of Texas. We got lots of farms, so we buy locally in Ontario. But if we have a wet season, we'll buy from Michigan or Illinois, somewhere close by, which is local as well. Now, all of our grains, by law, has to be fermented in Canada. They have to be distilled in Canada, and they have to be aged in Canada for a minimum of 3 years. The average person will hear that and think, of course. And they're like, well, that's not always the case with a lot of other categories of whiskey. So that's something that is unique, that fermentation, distillation, aging has to happen in Canada. Our distillation, we can distill any way we choose. Column distill, column and pot distill, double column distill. The way we age, minimum 3 years. And the law states a wooden cask under 700 liters, which is a huge barrel, obviously. I've never heard of anyone aging whiskey in Canada in a barrel like that. But like Scotland and Ireland, we buy up a lot of your ex-bourbon casks. So we've got, currently we have 1.6 million barrels laying down aging. We use a lot of ex-bourbon casks. We use a lot of new American oak, new French oak. We do a lot of finishings, different types of sherries, rums, wines, you name it. Dr. Don will have a lot of fun with that. He has a PhD in brewing and distilling. So his dissertation was what wood does to spirits. If you had him on, he could talk for hours about this. And then, you know, minimum, we have to be bottled at 40 ABV, 80 proof, pretty common. We can add caramel coloring, also very common. And that's kind of it. Now, what's unique about Canadian whiskey, and we'll get into this one, is this is not law, but it's more tradition. Is all of these grains that show up at Hiram Walker on a daily basis. I call her our gatekeeper. Alice is the woman who accepts the grain or does not accept the grain. All of it, corn, rye, wheat, and barley, from the time it arrives, it stays on its own until it's blended. So it's all fermented separately. It's all distilled separately, and we distill in different ways. It's all aged separately in different types of casks for different amounts of time, minimum being 3 years. And then this is why Canada has master blenders. They'll take all those finished whiskeys and they'll create different expressions from them.
So there's no mash bill like a bourbon or a rye?
We'll explain it. We had a group of 100 bartenders on today, all American bartenders. And we were, you know, the way you explain it is it's almost opposite of bourbon category, where that master distiller, he, she, they will make the mash bill and then make it all. We do it in an opposite way, where it's all finished whiskey that then gets blended together. Dr. Don will always say he has a blank palate to work with. And the three whiskeys we're going to walk through tonight, as I mentioned before, they all are completely different, which makes it a lot of fun. And you can kind of see what he can do. So the first one, J.P. Weiser, 18. I probably should mention that J.P. Weiser is an actual gentleman from Trenton, New York, moved to Ontario in 1857, bought his first distillery and started making whiskey. He bought the distillery because he wanted to make whiskey, but his main thing was he was a cattle breeder in the U.S. And he bought the distillery to feed his cattle that spent grain that had all the extra nutrients in it. And he was actually very successful business-wise. He was the first North American to sell cattle to the U.K. What you've got in front of you.
Oh, wait. We forgot one thing.
Hold on one sec. We have to do a cheers. Cheers, Dave, for coming on.
Cheers, gents. Thank you for having me.
Oh, of course.
Thank you. Fun.
Thank you. It was right.
And you're saving me from finishing some emails, so this is even better.
We're here now.
Now, most traditional Canadian whiskey, is a majority of a soft double column distilled corn. If you think of the big names of Canadian whiskey, like J.P. Weiser's being one of them, it's going to be a majority of soft corn whiskey with generally a little pinch of rye added to it. That's kind of what traditional style is. Now, what you've got in front of you, this is 100% corn whiskey. There's no other grain in this. 100% corn, column distilled once to strip away all the harsh qualities and characteristics from the spirit. Then we double column distill it. We run it again through another still. This is very Canadian style, traditionally. And what that does is it strips away a lot of the big flavors from the grain and yeast and leaves you with this light styled whiskey. This is where Canadian whiskey producers back in the mid-1800s honestly started taking out moonshiners, because that was all we knew at the time, up here at least, when we were making whiskey, was moonshine. And when the next group of whiskey makers we're going to talk about in the next whiskey started double column distilling, all the other whiskey makers started following suit, and Canadian whiskey became very well known and well liked around the world because it was a soft, easy sipping whiskey. So after we run this with the still the second time, it comes out at about 94-95% ABV, goes into the barrel at about 78%, and then we put this into ex-Canadian whiskey casks, which are the ex-bourbon cask. Once we use an ex-bourbon cask, we'll reuse it over and over. Basically, Don would tell you now, he'll use it over and over until it falls apart. Now, with the 18-year-old whiskey, the youngest blend in this bottle is 18 years. So you'd imagine if he uses the barrel five times, you know, you're looking at over 100 years for that barrel. I think out of our entire lineup of whiskeys, it's the lightest, easiest sipping. I mean, it's a light gold, as you are well aware. On the nose, I mean, I always get some of that, like, autumn spice. A lot of the grain and yeast characteristics come out from the used casks. I certainly get a lot of vanilla. Our warehouses in Windsor. Windsor's the most southern tip of Canada. So in the summers, we go up to 95 degrees Fahrenheit. It gets hot. Now, in the winters, it's still Canada, and it's still a cold region on the Great Lakes. It's, you know, you can get down to, I mean, this is extreme, but you get to negative 40 Fahrenheit. We've had that before. Like, it's just one extreme to the other. And that's where things really freeze up. Everything except the whiskey. You go in the warehouses, the barrels will have a light coat of frosting on them. It's non-temperature controlled warehouses. In the springtime, you'll see the floors will be wet for the first month because the condensation. We're opening up the garage doors, the warm air is coming in, the sun's coming down on it, and the barrels expand and retract. Most people who visit the distillery who are used to other distilleries usually comment right away on our hoops. The hoops are so rusty just from having that constant condensation. So this the ethyl acetate is what I'm kind of getting to, formation of that, which is essentially the character of green apple, pear drops, which will be hidden in different types of whiskeys for the way they're made, but it really shines through in this. I get like almost a green apple dipped in caramel.
Yeah, I got a lot of the candy notes.
Candy,
a lot of sugars. Really nice.
Leather on the nose.
Really nice.
You know what surprises me, though? We've talked about this before, but this is 40% ABV?
It is.
It's pretty spicy. Even though it's 40 ABV, it's got a little bit of heat.
It's got that, yeah. I mean, right now I've got the little warming sensation right now.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Real nice finish.
Those ex-casks, like you say, bourbon was in there, and then it does give, I call it almost an autumn spice. It reminds me, you know, with that, the apple, and I can't say red apple. It does remind me of Granny Smith. But that's just me. I mean, we're all going to smell and nose and taste different things from the expression.
What I've always been impressed with the 18, because I've had a couple bottles before as well, and how moderately priced it is retail. It's not $10 a year. It's not $180.
Yeah.
It's like 60, I think 70 maybe max.
I was going to say, I think it's in between. It depends on the state you're going to be in.
Yeah.
Or province. But yeah, it's generally around the 60 to 70 mark.
Yeah.
And I love that. And
it's
I
great.
Think most consumers love that.
Yeah.
What would you make with this if you were going to make a cocktail?
If we're going to do a cocktail, I'd probably do some form of a highball, something a little more
refreshing. Yeah, I was like, wondering about that. Yeah, I was thinking because you don't want to like get lost.
Exactly. If you took a big vermouth
right,
The big vermouth would overpower
it. Yeah. Right, or even if you made a sour, it would just overpower. You'd lose all the subtlety or any of that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, it's really, really good. I'll be dipping into it again. So this is where we jump into our first leg of the other half of this podcast, which is what we watch. And Dave was the one that sort of brought this up in our exchanges of what would be a good thing to talk about. We talked about Planes, Trains, and Automobiles because it stars John Candy, who is from Toronto. Dave, what's your history with this movie? Because I've got a long one. It's such a wonderful movie.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm a 76 baby. So, you know, growing up in the 80s, growing up with John Hughes movies.
Yep.
Whether it was Breakfast Club, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, 16 Candles, right. Just Having a Baby, whatever it was, National Lampoon's Vacations. Like, that's what my parents were watching. I was watching it. And I mean, just John Hughes and John Candy alone. I mean, we're talking Train, Planes, and Automobiles. We're talking The Great Outdoors. We're talking Uncle Buck.
Yep.
All like, of them. 3 years in a row.
Yeah.
Same guy wrote them. Like, same guy started them. John Candy was obviously, like, you know, always will be, as far as I'm concerned, one of our heroes in the Hollywood world or comedic world, you know, from his early days of SCTV and like right up to doing big films with John Hughes, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. I think I read somewhere it was his favorite film that he made of his own.
Huh. Oh, that's interesting.
Which said quite a bit. I thought it was pretty cool.
He's never bad. He's really never bad. And he steals the show on more than one occasion.
He really does. And like, obviously I dug in a little bit, like started reading up knowing we were coming to talk. And I just wanted to see what I could find, like behind the scene things about the movie. Cause I watched the movie after you and I talked. I watched it recently where I watched it over the holidays. I was at my parents' house and it just happened to be on. And I went, this is perfect. And it held up, you know, I still laughed my ass off. The jokes were great. Here's something I think is really weird. I read this the other day when I was looking into it. Who knows if it's true? John Hughes, originally, the two original actors he wanted to play the parts, Steve Martin's role, he wanted it to be Tom Hanks. And John Candy's role, he wanted it to be John Travolta.
No, oh, my God.
No. Hanks, I could see. Hanks has...
I can see Hanks.
Yeah. Hanks, I could see. But Travolta?
That would have been just terrible. That would have been. Just terrible.
No,
been
no, 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 no. John Goodman.
It's a whole different movie.
John Goodman,
John Goodman, maybe, because he's, I think, on the same level as Candy. He could do comedy. He could do drama. He's just another fantastic actor.
And, I mean, I think John Candy, too. It's like, certainly that role. I mean, I came across a quote from Steve Martin, and I can't quote it, but he was saying that real life John Candy compared to his character Del Griffith in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, he said it was, they're very alike, where, you know, they're the most kind, considerate, happy-go-lucky, kind of goofy, nice guys. But I thought it was kind of sad at the end. He goes, but they both kind of have a little bit of a broken heart inside. John Candy always came across as that lovable, big teddy bear, like 6'2", 300-pound guy who just loved everybody and wanted to please everybody. But anything I've read about him, like he struggled with weight.
Yeah,
and, you know, tried to be better. Like, there was a thing Steve Martin was making jokes about. John Candy had exercise equipment brought into the set for Planes, Trains, and Automobiles to lose weight. But he said he didn't use the stuff once, the whole suit. So it's like, I think like many of us,
he was we've all done that.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Hey, guess what? Somebody's like trying to bust in here.
Who's bucking in?
I don't know. I think they got through the firewall.
What? We have a firewall?
We
paid for a firewall?
I don't know. Apparently.
It's just
apparently.
I see whiskey international hacker. Is that who I think
it is? I don't know. It could be.
Who is this?
It might be the last hacker. Should we let her in?
A hacker. Sure.
Should we let her in? All right.
I guess she's like the fourth member of our freaking show.
Oh, my God. Look who it is.
Oh, my God. It's Bob Hope. Is that Bob Hope?
Hey-o.
It's
hey-o.
What? Look at that.
How much have you guys already drank? That's my number one question.
We're only on number one.
It's early.
Just one.
We are.
This is what happens when we feed Americans Canadian whiskey. I'm telling you now.
All kinds of riffraff in.
I'm telling you now.
We are lucky. I guess we are honored. The Whiskey Lassie is here. That's amazing.
Oh my God.
And I believe Joanne and Dave know each other. That is crazy.
I'm just trying to think. I'm like, I can't think of the last time we were face to face.
We go way back. 2012.
Well, we were bringing people. We were bringing friends together again. Joanne, thanks for coming on.
Let's just say you didn't have so much gray in your beard, and I didn't have so much white in my hair. That's how long it's been.
So this is pre-pandemic, huh?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Yeah, but you know what? You're both wearing it well.
Well, yeah. Okay.
A little gray. Nothing wrong with gray.
We are talking John Candy and Planes, Trains, and Automobile. But before we go back to the movie, what is your thoughts, ideas, history with, we just had the Weiser's 18, for instance.
Oh, that's what I'm drinking.
That's what she's drinking. What are the odds? So what is your flavor notes on it?
Never tell her the odds.
Never tell me the odds.
Or leave her with a gun.
Working for the federal government has its pleasures. Just saying.
And not just a corporate card.
I know, right? What do I think of Weiser's 18? I would have to say it's not one of my go-to whiskeys. It's one of those bottles that I have that if I'm having a really crappy day, I want to say shitty day.
You can say that.
If I'm having a really shitty day, it's like I'll,
don't have filters.
I'll storm into my whiskey room and I'll go straight to the 18 and then I'll look at how much I have left in the bottle and go, but is it really a crappy day or should I just kind of like so I tend to really, and I don't share that one with anyone. That's like, it's like my Häagen-Dazs of whiskeys. Which is,
good metaphor.
I know, right? It's like, I don't share my Häagen-Dazs chocolate ice cream either. But so the Weiser's 18 gets hidden.
How popular is this for you and Dave? How popular is the 18 in Canada versus here in the States? I mean, maybe that's a bad question. I assume it's a go-to on bar shelves in Canada, because it's not here, right? So no. Much.
JP Weiser's the brand in Canada. I'll say it's always number two in sales across Canada.
Mm-hmm.
The Crown usually overtakes us in sales, but we're right behind them at all times. But JP Weiser's in Canada does very well. Even on a scale, if you want to get down to numbers internationally, it's like the second largest Canadian whiskey globally. Now, JP Weiser's 18, your whiskey bars in Canada. Joanne can tell me if I'm wrong. I mean, I think you're going to be safe to find a bottle of JP Weiser's 18 on most whiskey bars across Canada.
Yep.
Are you going to find it at every bar?
No.
Like cocktail bar and stuff? No. And
whiskey bars? Yes.
Whiskey bars? Yes. Yeah. And to be quite honest, you know, each province where, you know, Ontario, you could almost call Ontario a controlled state, like the LCBO that distributes our spirits. If I'm out going to buy a round of our whiskeys to put into kits or take or shows, it's one of the ones that'll be hard for me to find, which is frustrating at times. So it's not, you have to go to some of the larger spirit stores to guarantee finding it, but you don't see it regularly on shelves everywhere.
You know, I don't bullshit or baffle brains anytime when it comes to how I feel about whiskeys, but JP Weiser is probably, like, of my Canadian whiskey collection, it's probably close to almost 50% of my Canadian whiskey collectibles. I have the JP Weiser's Red Letter. I have like a whole bunch of weird releases that I got my hands on ASAP, and a lot of them don't get released across Canada. So you're literally hustling to get some of these bottles because they're that collectible.
Are they distillery only releases, or there you have to go to the LCBO to get those? Or both.
Some across Canada, but Joanne's 100% right. Some are provincial.
Yeah.
So we released a JP Weiser's Union 52 in British Columbia a few years ago.
I have it. Oh, I mean, no big deal. I got a bottle of it.
That is a hoarder.
Well, that's a hard one to get because it's blended. It's a 15-year-old corn whiskey aged in New American oak with probably, I'd have to, don't quote me on this, but I probably about 4% of a 52-year-old Scotch blended into it.
Oh, wow. That's wacky.
Like, pretty. Told you. And that's the fun stuff. He had some stuff sitting around. You know, this is where I learned. I asked him one day, I'm like, Don, do you ever do you ever come out, you know, out of those 1.6 million barrels, do you ever come across like a lost barrel or something that's been set aside and you don't know? And Joanne knows Don. He's a scientist. He's raised in a lab. Like, he looked at me, he goes, no. He's like, we get audited twice a year. He goes, there's no such thing as a lost barrel. He's like, that's marketing. And I'm like, oh, well, you've taken the romance out of it. But he said, I have a list of things that were left over from previous distillers or master blenders that they didn't know what to do with. One of them was there were 18 barrels of a 50-year-old scotch. And I was like, hey, why do we have 18 barrels of a 50-year-old scotch in our Canadian distillery? And he was like, 50 years ago, somebody probably brought that in to blend in for the 9.09 rule. I'm like, oh, okay.
Somebody lost a bet. Come on.
Yeah. And, you know, we tried it. It was pretty much unpalatable on its own. And you know, he took it to drain and fill 2 years later. And out of the 18 barrels, he got one full barrel.
Wow.
You know, 3% evaporation every year.
Yeah.
We lose 48,000 barrels a year.
Oh, my God.
And
that's
insane.
Made
this blend. He made the blend with the corn whiskey, the scotch, brand team, you know, the Union of Canada and Scotland of who kind of brought in whiskey making to us. 52-year-old scotch. They called it J.P. Weiser's Union 52. And it sold out overnight because there were only a few thousand bottles of it. And it went like hotcakes.
Wow.
I'll that's be right nuts. Back.
Okay.
Where are you going?
We'll be here.
Where's she going?
She'll be right back. Well, while she goes and runs off and go get her Union 52 bottle.
Show off. She going to the vault?
Go to the vault. Well, if she has the combo. Well, she has to get the guard, wake up the guard, and then he's got the key, and then we'll
see. Two keys. There's two keys to open it.
It's like a missile sub? Is that what it is?
Exactly. It's like a silent
code.
Yeah, right. I was never here.
One ping only.
Mr. Kamarov. Oh, wait. Wrong movie. Wrong show.
Wrong movie. That's a different.
So, episode. Dave, I wanted to ask you a question. I have an old bottle of Windsor Canadian.
Oh yeah.
That you know, it's just something I picked up. It's been under the house, and on it, it says that it was distilled and blended under the supervision of the Canadian government. But then it says it was bottled in New York. Is it still Canadian whiskey?
If it was,
is there a bottling rule in Canada?
No, not bottling, because you can imagine. Think of it this way: Hiram Walker and Sons Distillery, we bottle 5 million cases a year, and probably a million of them are ours, and the rest are other things. So we do, I mean, we sell in bulk. We're even at the point now, our J.P. Weiser's 10-year-old, this is the first time we've ever done this. It's been doing so well in Europe that we're having it bottled in Europe. So it's like, again, law, it's got to be fermented, distilled, aged in Canada, blend it in Canada, and it gets shipped over, and there's a plant that bottles it for us there.
Interesting.
And it's still Canadian whiskey.
Exactly,
I just want to show this, and then I'm going to tap out, let you guys keep talking about guy stuff, whatever, planes, trains, automobiles, something or other, blah, blah, blah.
Gears.
Whatever.
Guy Tires. Stuff.
Come guy on. Stuff. Whatever.
Transportation.
So I've held on to this since 2017. I still haven't opened it.
It's an audio medium, Joanne. You got to tell us what it is.
Can you see the date?
No.
150.
It's called J.P. Weiser 150.
Wow.
So in 2017, Canada turned 150 years old. Don't know who came up with this idea, but what they did is they released whiskeys under the 150 commemorative series that had a specific date for every year. And Don and I share a very close birthday. So he's also born, I'm not going to say when exactly, but it's 1 or 2 days before or after me. I'm older, obviously. But he went out of his way to see where this bottle was being released in Canada, got it for me, and sent it to me as my birthday present.
What a good
guy. I know. He's amazing. And I have yet to open it, and I don't know when I'm going to open it. Maybe when I retire is when I'll actually open it. But to me, it's got so much dust on it at this point, and I love that bottle. If I die, it's willed to one of you, but I'm not going to say which one. Not you, Dave. You have enough whiskey.
Definitely,
definitely not
me.
Mike.
Definitely not me.
That narrows it down.
That's very pretty. That's pretty cool.
I know, right? Like, that's what I love about, you know, and even I have to say, honestly, for as far as the distillery is to me or to a lot of other people, I highly recommend people take the time to get there and go on the tour, because it is one of the best Canadian whiskey distillery tours. It just is. Don's amazing, and the site is amazing, and you get to see, I don't know if he does it with everybody, but we get to go to the top of the grain where they keep the grain on the roof. You get to see Windsor and Detroit like from the top of the roof, and then, you know, you get the full experience. You go in the lab, you get to look into microscopes and see what things look like, which of course makes me drool because I'm a chemistry geek. And then you spend the entire day, you end up at one of the warehouses, you know, tasting whiskeys out of barrels.
It's research, Joanne. It's all research.
It is. And I've seen so many barrels with Dave's signature on them. Honest to God, he must go in there at least once a week is all I'm saying about that. But anyways, I'm going to go ahead.
I was going to say, you get taken on the, there's the two tours. So there's one you pay $20 for and you get taken in the distillery, fermentation, distillation, and a little tasting. But there's the tour Joanne's talking about, which is, it's the VIP tour. It's the bartender, whiskey nut, whiskey writers, whiskey geeks that I've had friends call me out that I went on your tour and I didn't do any of your stuff I see on Instagram. I'm like, yeah, that's a different tour. But I'm sure if you gents made your way to Windsor, we would make sure you went on the same tour that Joanne and I get to go on.
Very cool. Thank you.
I'm actually, I talked the Montreal Whiskey Club into going this summer. So I think we're going to have like a busload of people show up. Well, I mean, obviously I'm going to tell Dawn beforehand and actually book spaces and whatnot. But yeah, we're taking this across Canada and we're like turning into a geek weekend. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
Oh, that'll be great.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if you'll stay in Windsor for the night, but if you need any Detroit recommendations, let me know. There's some fun spots just across the river.
I actually, I don't want to say lived in Windsor for a little while, but I'm a grandma or a Gigi now. And when my daughter gave birth, because of my Italian background, as soon as she told me she was pregnant, I'm like, I'm moving in for 6 to 8 weeks. And she was like, excuse me? And so I lived in Windsor for 2 months because I was literally like, I'm moving in. That's it. That's all. So I spent a lot of time. I actually sailed out of the club there and I hung around with Tish while I was down there, and I went to Detroit on a regular basis because that's like one hell of a hopping city in the good areas.
The good part.
I got lost a couple times by accident.
Oops.
I was gonna say, yeah, I've hit, just for the experience, I've been taken to a couple of the neighborhoods that I wouldn't be bringing my bartenders to.
Exactly.
This is National Lampoon's vacation scene here.
Whiskey style, whiskey vacation.
Burning National Barrel. Lampoon's what whiskey kids? Vacation. Look, kids, Burning Barrel. Keep going. Anyways, listen, it was a pleasure seeing you guys. Dave, I'm so glad you got to hang around with these nut bars because that's what they are.
Oh, right. Thanks, Joanne. You're so sweet.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks for coming on.
This was such a treat. When I tell Don that you were on, he's going to get a little jealous, so I'm going to brag about that I get to see you.
Please do.
Thanks, Joe.
All right, guys. Have a fun cheers. Time.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Joe.
How do I get out? Cheers. How do I get out? Oh, no.
Oh, we'll get you out. The security guard coming at you.
Bye.
See ya.
Good night. Thank you. Well, that was special.
That was awesome.
Glad we raised gone. The Canadian content percentage way up, didn't we?
Nice.
Right there.
So wait, wow, can we go awesome. From unofficial to official, you think?
We might be official now. Uh-uh. Now we're officially.
Can we be on like the Ontario Visitors Board podcast of record? Canada.
Yes.
We brought out the whiskey big guns with her. That's awesome.
Yeah, we don't play,
we
man.
We wanted to surprise you with that little yes.
We don't play. This is how we roll.
So before we get back to the movie, why don't we go to our second whiskey?
Yes, the Gooderham and Warts.
How do you say it?
We're all good. Gooderham and Warts.
Gooderham, just Gooderham.
Gooderham.
Got it.
Just William Gooderham and James Warts, two gentlemen that came over from Suffolk, England to the town of York, which is now the city of Toronto. They were grain millers. They set up shop. They were the guys that you brought your grain to be milled into flour. They were very successful. They were so successful that they couldn't sell it fast enough. Rot was setting in, mildew, rodents would get into it. They were throwing profit down the drain, basically. The short version of the story was they decided to start distilling whiskey. They were the gents who came up with the double column distillation, one of their architects in the distillery. all the other Canadian whiskey producers started following suit, but these guys were doing very well. Like, they were being sold, selling whiskey in the U.S., overseas. By the year 1877, they were producing more whiskey out of their distillery in downtown Toronto than any other distillery in the world. They, you know, suffered during American Prohibition, during Canadian Prohibition, to where the plant, you know, was closed down. It survived two world wars. They shut their doors in, I think it was 1990. And then it was brought back to life about a decade later. Toronto has about 155 neighborhoods. One of our neighborhoods is called the Distillery District. This is how large this distillery was. It is an entire neighborhood. All the buildings are condos now. They're restaurants, they're bars, they're little shops to buy your dog clothes.
So is this whiskey now made at the big location?
Hiram Walker.
It's all made at Hiram Walker. Now, so tell us about this guy.
So this guy, I mean, it's, again, it's nice, like, rich gold color. When we started making the brand again in 2016, it had been gone for years and years. Someone in marketing said, we should bring this back. Don, being a whiskey geek, said, I'll do it. And I've got an idea. An ode to whiskey makers, where Canadian whiskey is generally soft corn with a pinch of rye. He said, I want to do a four grain. And this is what he did. It is a seven distillate four grain whiskey. So it's wheat, barley, corn, and rye. 90% aged in new American oak, 10% aged in ex-bourbon casks. And I mean, when I nose this, when I nose and take a sip, I'm walking through it. Like, I get the breadiness of that wheat right away. It's like fresh baked bread.
It's really beautiful. It's, you know, really delicious.
Yeah. And you really pick up the grains in the first taste.
I'm really getting that soft, like, you know, sweet, rich corn. You're getting a lot of the warming vanilla and coffee and caramel from the cask. I mean, and you're getting that beautiful, I just, that rye spice, that, like, the heat, you know, you're getting all the cinnamon, the cloves, the baking spices.
What's the connection from this to the original things coming out of the distillery 10, 20, 30 years ago?
There's no real connection except the name.
And you mentioned how the 18-year-old tasted hotter than 40%.
Yes. This one's a little softer. It's got a nice bite to it.
I think this one's 44.4%.
That is the sense of humor of a scientist with a PhD in brewing distilling. He wanted his four-grain whiskey to be 44.4 ABV.
Should have been 44.44.
Hey, Mike. Yeah. It's the Moses Malone whiskey. Fo-fo-fo.
Yeah, fo-fo-fo. That's right. Well, it's delicious. I really like it. So I've never had it.
I noticed the two bottles are distinctively different, but I'm assuming they hold the same volume. Is there a rule in Canada about the bottle and what the bottle has to contain, so you don't confuse the purchaser with a big bottle looking like it holds more and
another bottle? I mean, that'd be a better question for the marketing team, but I don't think so. I mean,
because it just changed here in the States. We can do 700s now.
Oh, is that official?
Yeah.
I have one of these bottles from 1940.
Oh, look at that. Look at that.
This has 25 fluid ounces in it.
25 fluid ounces. 25. That's like less. That's so, like, over 700-ish, right?
Yeah, it's a little bit less than whatever you'd actually have.
Wow.
And it fits the bottle. You know, this is the way the bottle came out, but it's not like a standard. You wouldn't be allowed to sell this in the U.S. now. It would have to fit a different thing. It would have to be, you know, metric instead of what we have.
I feel like we're close to you guys because we're not. It's not like Europe. I mean, it'll be interesting to see if your rules change to 700. You can do it if we'll get there. But I mean, for the most part, you know, we got 500 milliliters. We've got 750s, which are pretty standard.
Yeah.
You've got 1140s, which are kind of like what bars and restaurants buy. And then we've got what you call, and this is something I learned through this job. If you'd go to a university party or just any big party, there are bottles that are called Texas Mickeys.
Oh.
You ever heard of a Texas Mickey?
I remember Mickey's. What's a Texas Mickey? No.
Texas Mickey. And I need to look up the size of it. I don't want to lie to you. And I've had so many Americans tell me, like, they're like, you're joking. That's a lie. You're making it up. I'm like, no, this is a thing.
What the hell?
Is a Texas Mickey?
Yeah, 3,000 milliliters. So 106 ounces. And so you guys probably Googled it.
I did.
And I have Americans are like, why is it called Texas Mickey? I'm like,
because everything's big in Texas.
It's an American thing.
Yeah.
Because everything's big in Texas.
And that's kind of my reasoning. So I'm like, when I found out that they're not called Texas Mickeys anywhere else except Canada, I was like, where is this coming from? And it's got to be everything is bigger in Texas.
Do you guys bottle anything in Texas Mickeys?
So you'll see a few of the Canadian whiskeys, but I think it's more like vodkas.
Oh, so
we say it's okay. For kind of those frat party bottles or
right.
A boys camping trip or snowmobiling trip or something up in the woods for a weekend.
Do they have a handle on them? No handles?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Wheels? Got a handle. Did it have wheels on it?
Some, if you Google it later, some come with a pump that you put into the top.
Oh, that's cool.
Fancier ones come with a swing. So you put it on.
Oh, yeah. I had one.
Oh, yeah. I've seen those on cruises where you can buy the monstrous handle and the swing.
Yeah.
That's pretty funny.
Those are great. And they work. They actually physically work.
Yeah, they work. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
So funny. Oh, that's great.
For all of our stuff, everything's 750 mil. And then we've got a few of the JP Weisers that are in the 1140.
This is really great. I had never had any.
I like this
Goodermann
one.
And Wards. It's really delicious.
It's got a little bit more like different flavors going on. I like it better than the Weisers, I think. It just has a little bit more of a punch.
Well, and I was going to say, it's the majority of it's that soft corn, but it's about equal amount of the pot distilled rye.
Uh-huh.
And then you've got probably less than 5% of the wheat and the barley in there. Yeah. If anything, we've noticed in the U.S., Gina and I, when we're doing whiskey shows or cocktail festivals and we've got a booth set up, you know, there's always one guy that walks up and goes, I'm a bourbon guy. I don't like Canadian whiskey. And I'll usually respond, thanks for letting me know.
Go away.
Typical American.
While you're here, can I try to convince you that you might
like
Canadian whiskey? And when I've got a bourbon drinker, I'll usually grab this bottle and, you know, I'll watch them a little smile come up on the side of their mouth, and they might not want to admit they like it, but they'll enjoy it. This is a sipper.
I like it. It's really, really good.
I really like it.
It's really nice.
What's that? Any idea what that retails for in the States-ish?
I would say under 50.
Oh, my gosh.
Like that's 40, great. 40 to 45.
That's reasonable.
Depending on the state. And
that's great.
I mean, the corn and the rye is 10-year, but we can't call it a 10-year because the wheat and the barley is probably about 5-year. So we no age statement. On its own, it's great.
And again, same deal where it's being blended, like individually distilled grain, so and then blended together.
It is seven different whiskeys fermented, distilled differently, and aged differently, blended together.
Fun.
It's just neat.
Wild.
And this one has a batch number on it. Are they all batched, labeled with a batch?
I'm going to look at my label.
This one says A.A.1129.
1129, yeah. Blend, that's on mine too, so that's just going to be a thing from the, that's going to be from Don's distillery of what that was from.
Got it, okay.
Yeah, this one on its own, but also like, that's this works for cocktails. You want to make a Manhattan
the same thing.
This, you know, bartenders get cheeky. A lot of bartenders use it to make Toronto cocktails, which makes sense, you know, the Toronto's whiskey, a Toronto cocktail. And I like to be cheeky where Canada or Toronto is certainly not known for classic cocktails being originated here, not like New Orleans or New York. But the first documentation of a sour on paper was in a Toronto saloon in 1856. So I like to think that this was the local distillery since 1837. By the year 1856, I'd like to think they might have been using, if not whiskeys, they did make a gin there too. So maybe they were using a... one of their spirits.
Yeah. Very good. Excellent. Well, let's get back to our movie, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. We talked a little bit about John Candy and Steve Martin a little bit, and John Hughes we touched on. Maybe we talk about what the movie's about for a moment.
Shall we read a little recap?
Yeah. Why don't you do that, Angie? You usually do that?
Sure, why not? Give me something to do. Keep me busy. Keep me busy. Let me find it. Okay. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is a 1987 American comedy film written, produced, and directed by John Hughes and starring Steve Martin and John Candy with supporting roles by Layla Robbins and Michael McKean. It tells the story of a high-strung marketing executive and a good-hearted but annoying shower curtain ring salesman who become travel companions when their flight is diverted and share a three-day odyssey of misadventures trying to get to Chicago in time for the executive's Thanksgiving Day dinner with his family. The film received critical acclaim, with many praising it for Hughes's branching out from teen comedies and for Candy's and Martin's performances. It has become a Thanksgiving Day tradition for many.
It's a great story. It's a great concept of a story.
It is.
And it's funny how it's become like a Thanksgiving thing. I don't remember, you know, it's what, you said 87?
87.
So it's around for 35 years or something. I don't remember that 20 years ago we were thinking about this as a Thanksgiving movie, but it's become one. American Thanksgiving movie, by the way.
Yeah.
I rewatched this Sunday and Monday. I haven't seen it in at least 20 years.
It holds up.
It really does. It really does. For the first couple, like 10, 15 minutes, it took me a minute because I'm just like, I really liked this movie before. Do I still like it? And then once it kicks into gear, I loved it. And by the end, it's just, you know, it's sweet. It's good. You know, there's some transformation of character. You know, John Candy's fantastic. Steve Martin's really good. It's just a great movie. It really is.
John Hughes, too, like, you know, he pulls out a lot of his regular, like, I can't think of her name.
Edie McClurg.
Edie McClurg.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, she's fantastic.
The famous F-word scene.
Oh, like, you she's know, fantastic.
He was just brilliant.
She's doing her thing with
cast
a pen
of characters.
In her hair. Yeah.
Or yeah. I read this and I didn't realize it. So it's like the same year John Hughes had filmed She's Having a Baby starring Kevin Bacon. And then he gets Kevin Bacon to do the taxi stealing scene.
Right.
For him and train
yeah, his
automobile. Right.
When they're at the hotel later, when they're drinking all the little Mickeys and they're having the Doritos, the movie in the background, which hadn't been released yet, was She's Having a Baby starring Kevin Bacon.
Oh, that's funny.
Oh, wow.
That's funny.
You know, little tidbits like that I think are pretty cool.
There's a lot of cool little things. Like when he first meets John Candy in the airport and they're kind of just looking at each other. The book he's reading with the, you know, the little trashy novel.
Canadian Mounted.
The Canadian Mounted. I was just like, that's hysterical. That's just so funny.
I think one of the things that surprised me the most.
Is that on your shelf, by the way, Dave?
That's hidden. I've got the VHS copy.
Nice.
I started deep diving into a John Hughes thing. John Hughes wrote the screenplay in 22 hours. The original cut of the movie of Trains, Planes, and Automobiles was 3 hours and 40 minutes.
Yeah.
Then they cut it down to 2 hours, and then the studio made them cut it to 1 hour and 33 minutes for theatrical release. But it was originally 3 hours and 40 minutes.
Yeah, there's actually more cut out of the movie than the actual movie.
And, you know, the site I got on was explaining it. Like, you know, the scene in the movie where they're asleep in the first hotel room and the robber comes in and steals from them. Or the burglar, not robber. Apparently the whole scene of that is, it's a hilarious scene of John Candy's character, Del Griffith, ordering pizza. And Steve Martin's character wanted salad. Apparently there was none. Came, the poor delivery guy had a horrible tip from them. Waited, and when they fell asleep, he was the guy who came and burglarized.
He's the robber. Okay. Yeah.
Well, he did mention that he ordered a pizza, didn't he? I think later in the movie.
Yeah, and I was going to say, the same little piece I was reading is they were saying there's, I don't know, if there were 5 to 10 things that are mentioned in the movie that did happen, but we as the audience don't see it happen, but it's mentioned later. And that was certainly, one of them, the pizza being ordered.
End of last year, they released a new, the 35th anniversary, I think, DVD thing.
Oh,
and
okay.
There's 37 minutes, I believe, of deleted scenes. And some of that's in there. And what I read as well, maybe we saw the same thing. He ultimately released the movie he wanted to release.
Yeah.
He didn't want to, these deleted scenes, which actually brought a little more context to certain parts of the movie, he didn't feel that they were necessary. So he took them out, and that was the movie he wanted to have. But 133, you said, it kind of feels a little bit longer than that to me. It feels, but it doesn't feel long. It feels like this is a well-told story that has a lot of things going on. It's a road movie, right? It's a buddy road trip movie, and you want to go lots of places with them. You don't want it to end quickly. You want to see them go from point A to point Z and all the little letters in between. And you do see that. You get to see them do all these little crazy things on the way, like Vacation.
Yeah.
I think part of the exasperation that you see from Steve Martin you don't get enough backstory on, because a lot of what got cut was the embellishments of John Candy's pieces.
Right.
Where when he told a story, he was just like, okay, just tell a story and we'll just keep filming it. And it went on and on and on. And you don't see some of that.
When I rewatched it, you know, I remember Steve Martin going off on him in the first motel room, you know, where he just goes on a tirade. I didn't remember it being that early in the movie, because it's really within like the first 30 minutes.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of this stuff that leads up to that is cut, so you don't get it. You know, by the end of the movie, you understand his exasperation. But early on, you're kind of like, I don't understand. Yeah. He seems like a nice guy.
Yeah, I was going to say, Steve Martin comes across as a bit of a jerk, just because he...
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Right. Fed up so quickly with him.
Well, Steve Martin's defense, Mike, you traveled with, you know, your troop, and Aaron, you traveled with your troop. The hotel thing where he gets out and all the towels are wet on the floor and it's just, you know, an absolute disaster. We've been there, right?
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
In some way we've all had that trip.
Yeah.
Or parts of it, right?
We went on vacation and my wife takes my daughter. And I get what I like to refer to as the Stink Brothers as my guests. And we're in Aruba where it's just stinking hot all the time. There's no humidity. My oldest son has wet flip-flops. So instead of just leaving his flip-flops outside where they would dry in minutes, he took the hairdryer and tried to dry his flip-flops. And what he wound up doing was basically melting them. So not only did my room smell like two boys, it smelled like burned rubber to the point where my wife and daughter would not come into our room for the rest of our stay. And you're just like, what did you do? I was drying them. Why?
Flip-flops. You put them outside.
Well, they were
wet. And you're in Aruba. There's like no humidity. They would have dried in what, 30 seconds?
What? Put them outside.
30 seconds they would have dried?
So yeah, I understand his exasperation. Yes. When he dries his face with John Candy's underpants, well, that's...
Hey, at least they were clean.
That rivals the they're not pillows.
They're not pillows. All the towels being used. He's got the little face cloth to try to dry off. That's
trying to dry himself off.
The scene, I think it's in the... I believe, is it the airport where John Candy's eating the hot dog? There's a deleted scene of him eating this hot dog. I saw part of it. And he's smoking a cigarette at the same time. So he's eating and smoking and there's smoke coming out of his mouth as he's actually eating. It is so, it's John Candy.
Yes.
I mean, he had to.
It's horrifying, but it's John Candy.
But it's John Candy's ad-libbing ability, right? Uh-huh. To just make this stuff up. And it's just insanely funny on film. That's the kind of stuff that I think gets cut out a lot because there's so much of it, right?
And I didn't catch it. I read it, went and looked back at it, is because they were out of money and John Candy kept going to figure things out. That scene where they're eating, if you look closely, some of the staff and another woman, they're wearing the hoops.
The hoops earrings.
He's clearly going in there and giving himself a free meal by giving them the earrings.
It's also fun to see, because it's 35 years ago, transportation in this continent at the time. And how airports worked, and how airplanes were.
Run to the gate.
You walked. You were on an airplane. Everyone got a meal.
You know what was funny?
Cars were different. It was all weird.
When the lights were out on the plane. I mean, New York to Chicago is a 2-hour flight.
Yeah,
you know, they're all passed out. But then they got diverted, so they could have been circling for another 2 hours. So
that's true.
So who knows? I mean, I was thinking about that. I'm like, that doesn't seem right.
Michael McKean as the state trooper.
Yeah,
the radio still works. How about that? The radio.
Ben Stein in another reprisal of a role from a prior movie.
The cab driver when they got to Wichita, he was the guy that was I think Bizarro Kramer on Seinfeld.
Oh, you're right. I think right.
Yeah, you are right.
Yes. So John Hughes has an interesting career path. You know, he's a writer at National Lampoon, and he writes some of these stories that ultimately become Vacation, things like that. And then he goes off to be, you know, write these movies. And he's like the biggest movie director of the teen comedy era.
Oh, absolutely.
In the early 80s, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's like, you can't touch him. He's got, we had just talked about Ferris Bueller indirectly on a previous episode here. We talked about The Freshman and Matthew Broderick coming off of that. He was the hottest commodity in acting at the time.
Right.
after coming off of Ferris Bueller. And then John Hughes kind of changes away from the whole teen comedy thing and gets into these adult dramedy, whatever this is called.
I'm going to say adult movies. That's another genre.
Adult, you know, serious comedies, if that's a term, where he's got Uncle Buck is kind of a serious movie, right? And this has got some pretty dark undertones to it. It's a complete change from where he started with these wacky articles in a college magazine, in essence, to teen comedy, sex romps to some extent, teen angst, to these, to this amazing film.
Going into my deep, dark hole of looking into all this, John Candy, I found this interesting. He has a record for being in the most John Hughes movies.
Really?
Really?
The Home Alone scene. Do you know what I'm about to tell you? The drama behind it?
No.
Well, Home Alone, he's the polka, right? Polka, polka, polka. We're very big in Sheboygan. The
polka guy, yeah, with Catherine O'Hara, another Canadian legend who they're like dear friends. He got paid $414 for his work on that movie. John Hughes said to him, listen, we can give you a little piece of the pie. Like, if you want to work out a deal where we won't pay you, but you can make profit off of the movie.
We got some points.
John Candy said, no, he's like, you're a good friend. I'll just do it. And they paid him $414. And then it became the largest grossing film for a few years. Right. They made $473 million. Wow. Like, someone did the math. He would have made like $4 million off of it or for his 20-minute scene or 20 minutes of work or whatever it took. I found that pretty crazy.
And that character comes right out of SCTV from the Schmingy Brothers.
The
right?
Schmingy Brothers.
Which yeah. I sent to Angelo and Mike a few days ago,
The Last Polka,
Movie, yeah. Which is the documentary of the Schmingy Brothers based on The Last Waltz. And it's incredibly funny, and I highly recommend it. That's another episode with Eugene Levy and
John Candy.
It's hard not to, for me, because I was just an SCTV nerd, to watch this and not think of SCTV and think about where the SCTV folks have gone over the years. And you know, John Candy's gone. When did he pass away?
1994.
94, right?
March 4th, 1994. That's my birthday.
Wow.
Almost 30 years.
And you see, like, Eugene Levy now, like, has this rebirth of a career later in life. And Catherine O'Hara everyone in that cast. And Harold Ramis, you know, as an actor and a director. And what would John Candy be today?
What would he be? Be 72, 73?
Same age as all those guys, right? Yeah.
Well, and then towards the end, I mean, he's in JFK.
He gets serious, right?
He was great in JFK.
Everything I was reading is he had a horrible slump, like his, you know, 87, 88, 89, yeah. Like pinnacle, like Spaceballs, Great Outdoors, Uncle Buck, like
right.
Kind of tapered off. And he, you know, perfect example, JFK was, you know, he still gets a lot of recognition because he really went out for that role. Like, yeah, dialect trainers, mm-hmm. he day and night went for it. It would have been interesting to see what would happen. Maybe he would have gone more of that route.
Yeah, I think so. I think he would have probably gone more serious. But then as you get older, you kind of come back to your roots. I could definitely see him having some comedic roles today. He'd be a hot commodity, I think. He was just so ahead of his time because I think a lot of those SCTV people were in a lot of ways. I think that whole group of people that came out of Toronto in New York or Chicago, Second City, they really were kind of cutting edge. They were really different from a lot of the things that were coming out of Hollywood. You know, they made a lot of money and they took a lot of lives along the way, like Belushi, for instance, but they were really different cats and it showed on film. It was, and on scripted shows and on SCTV and SNL. I mean, they were just a different kind of character, a comedic actor, and they all had those ad-lib skills. I always get the feeling watching John Candy that nothing is written for him. He's just going.
Yeah.
Right? And I think in the Hughes films, there's a lot of that. There's a lot of scripted stuff, but he kind of goes when he he goes where he wants to go. Yeah,
I think it's loose. It's a loose script.
You know, when he's selling he's selling the shower rings. That had to be like mostly improv.
That's all. Yeah.
Coming up with all the ridiculous whose rings they are and all this stuff.
He'd sure probably do a few takes with the exact script, but then John Hughes probably be like, "All right, just do your thing
right again."
The next few takes,
and that's why it was 345, whatever you said, 3 hours and 45 minutes, right? Totally.
One of the movies I loved him. I loved him in Only the Lonely. I think that was a great movie.
What movie, Mike?
Only the Lonely.
Only the Lonely. Although it's great.
Where he plays a Chicago cop and a love interest and all this with his mother, Maureen O'Hara.
Yeah.
Is Ally Sheedy?
Ally
Sheedy, yeah.
Ally Sheedy. I think that's where he was transitioning, he was still going to do not like the slapstick silly kind of comedy, but more cultured comedy and then still do some of these, you know, more dramedy kind of roles.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, he got locked into a couple of contracts to go and do some of his old stuff. And then he wound up having that massive heart attack down in Mexico. Well, he had to make that Wagons East, which he was contractually obligated to make, and he didn't want to make it. And they went down there and wound up dying.
Well, while we're at this point, why don't we move on to our last whiskey number 3, which is also number 40. Which is kind of weird.
There you go. And number 40, my bottle's there. It's a little empty, but the Lot 40, the Dark Oak.
It's a little empty. That's the Angel share.
Exactly. 3% around my apartment.
Isn't that
too.
The Dave share?
It's the Dave share, not the Angel
share. Dave share. I like that.
See?
No.
No, this one, this one sticks out at me, right? Because I can see it. It's a lot. My poor little eyes can't see the little writing. This one's 48%.
Yeah.
We've moved up here.
Yes.
Now, how is this different from Lot 40?
Well, I'll tell you.
Perfect.
I mean, Lot 40 itself, a little bit of a history to it, where most Canadian whiskey is that soft double column distilled corn with a little pinch of rye. In the late 90s, a previous master blender, Michael Booth, went to the company and said, what if we took that little rye that's sprinkled into Canadian whiskey and bottled it on its own? Hence where Lot 40 came from. Back in the late 90s, putting out 100% rye whiskey didn't really work out so well. You know, the time of Sex in the City and Cosmopolitans and cocktails that were fruity and neon colored. And
apple teenies.
To be quite honest, it failed pretty badly. And it went away. But, you know, fast forward into the early 2000s, London, UK, New York City, bartenders start pulling out old cocktail books. They start reviving cocktails that were made with two spirits, American rye or Canadian whiskey, you know, of the time of the late 1800s, early 1900s books. Mad Men takes over Sex and the City. Everybody wants a martini or an old fashioned or a Manhattan. Someone at our company says, remember that 100% rye that failed so miserably? What if we were to bring that back?
Let's do it again.
At this point, Dr. Don is now our master blender. He says, I'd like to take a shot at it. He changed the recipe a little bit. But Lot 40, basically, it's a 100% unmalted rye. We take it to the column still, disregard of any of the harsh qualities from the spirit. We then put this into our little pot still, 8,000 liter still for 12 hours. Which basically concentrates up all the rye notes because we discard of the heads and the tails. And that's basically getting rid of all the green grass and soapy characteristics of the whiskey. So we're left with the hearts. You're left with all the rye bread, baking spices, citrus, floral. I mean, it's rye. It packs a punch. We put it into New American Oak, level 2 char. And that's Lot 40. 43 ABV, 86 proof. Done very well over the last decade. Bartenders, whiskey geeks, it's kind of our cocktail whiskey. It holds up against any vermouth or herbal liqueur you're going to put it up against. So Dark Oak comes in because Dr. Don has a lot of fun with Lot 40. He puts out cask strengths and different variations. He decides to take the Lot 40 we know. He regages it in New American Oak after, but level 4 char. So American Oak, char level 2. American Oak char level 4 afterwards, and he bottles it at 48 ABV, 96 proof. We released this in March, April 2020. Now, imagine how well that did. And it's a bartender's whiskey. So we're like, it was going to be a one-off. We're like, we're going to sell it in Canada. That's what we're going to do. Brand teams, they always, you know, a new innovation, they send samples away to different whiskey shows and whiskey awards. And we get a call in 2021. we get a few calls. We get some like really nice double golds and some golds, and it was all great. But the World Whiskey Awards calls us up and says, "Oh, you're taking home World's Best Rye." And we're like, "Oh, World's Best Canadian Whiskey?" They're like, "Nope, you're taking home World's Best Rye." It's like, "Oh God!" Call the distiller. You know, the phone calls, emails to the distillery.
Get busy, like, Don.
They're like,
"We should make this now."
Like, what are we gonna do? Because you know, the original little batch we made is still out. Luckily, there's plenty of the liquid, but what happened during the pandemic was the black labels, the black corks, the different bottle. Like, that was just, it wasn't happening overnight. We got our act together as the world started opening back up, but we literally just launched the Lot 40 Dark Oak in the U.S. last October. That's why I was trying to remember if I did have it now.
Yeah, I think we did have it.
So, I mean, looking at it, you know, this is a really rich, almost amber mahogany color to it. I mean, I get rye bread off this right away.
Totally.
I'm not getting too much heat. A little bit of honey, almost like a eucalyptus kind of mint thing. But the first sip, like if Lot 40's got that warming vanilla, this is like a sweet vanilla ice cream to it.
It's got spice. It's got heat.
Yeah, it is really
it's
nice.
It's got the rye notes.
Lot,
oh my God. A
lot more cinnamon almost to it.
Yes.
And again, 48 ABV, 96 proof. It's not punching you in the jaw.
No.
It's
so No, it's not.
No, this is really nice. I like this.
You said that there's been cast strength versions of them. And I think I've had a couple of those, maybe at shows, at whiskey shows. What's the ABV on the cast strength ones?
So we did the first year we did a Lot 40 12-year-old cast strength. Then we did a Lot 40 11-year-old cast strength. We did a Lot 40. It was a non-age statement, but it was new oak, but it was French, new French oak.
Are these above 50%?
Yeah, they were. I might have a one. I just don't want to lie to you. I could go pull out bottles from my cabinet over here, but I want to see if I have it written down. I think one was like 57.9.
Ooh.
One was in the 60s.
Ooh.
Another cast strength he recently did a Lot 40 cast strength finished in quarter peated casks. So
Whoa.
It was really nice. It got mixed reviews because I loved it. I mean, I love rye and I like peated whiskey. I mean, people liked it, but it didn't go crazy. The coolest thing he put out was, I don't think we've done a single barrel release since the late 1800s. I don't think the distillery has. He had an 18-year-old, one barrel of an 18-year-old Coleman Pot distilled rye. He had one barrel of an 18-year-old Lot 40.
Wow.
And it was 155 bottles. The brand team put it together. It was very end of the pandemic. And I was like, what do we do with 155 bottles of an 18-year-old, like, single barrel cast strength rye?
Specialty stores, right?
155 bottles. So what they did was they set up an initiative called the Drop Collective, which Corby uses now for, like, all of their whiskeys. But it came down to, it was a lottery.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, we spent a month or so trying to get the word out as far as we could and as many people. And we're like, we're so sorry to do this, but it's the only way we could do this with any kind of fairness to it. And it was, put your name in. It wasn't a bid. It was under $300 for the bottle. Like, it was pretty fairly priced. But yeah, it was a lotto.
I love this. It's so good.
It is very good.
That heavy char really, that's a lot to it. It really kind of,
it just kind of makes it a little richer.
Brings in richer. There's maybe a tad of smoke to it. I mean, it's great. It'd be interesting to see a level 5 char.
Well, you never know. Like I said, he's got a lot of stuff going on. And
alligator rye.
Totally. I thought the same thing, man. I was thinking, I had Ardbeg
well,
in my
yeah,
head.
Right? Isn't that what they call it? Alligator char?
Yeah.
I love this. Like you say, I normally don't drink a straight rye on its own, but this is something I could sip on. And
totally.
I mean, this makes a killer Manhattan old fashioned. Like, ooh, it's a beautiful whiskey to, you take a big, like, Gokey Carpano vermouth and you make a Manhattan with this, it's stunning.
Hey, did we lose Mike? He looks like Candy or Steve Martin in the back of that pickup truck.
Hey, the guy that picks him up in that pickup truck.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's, he's in a lot of, Dylan Baker.
Yep, he's in a lot of stuff.
He's in a lot of stuff.
Uh-huh. Serious and not so serious.
And the best part about that is how many temperature degrees do you think they went through to find the one that was the funniest?
Oh my God.
When they get through, what do you think the temperature is? About one.
I love all his spitting.
That scene where he spits on his hand. No,
and he shakes his hand.
It was, the one thing I read was John Hughes asked him to do that, but they didn't tell Steve Martin.
Oh my God.
So the reaction was like of him being disgusted was actually like his real reaction.
Him being disgusted.
I thought was great.
He is good. And you don't have to pick that stuff, but she'll do it.
She's strong.
She'll get it.
Third kid came out sideways. Didn't complain. Didn't make a sound.
Oh, that's so funny. Oh my gosh. Wow. Any more thoughts on John Candy, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles? It rekindled a lot of love for me of John Candy.
Yeah, same.
And his career, his movies, SCTV. I went down on SCTV rabbit hole on YouTube, and I don't know that I'm going to be getting out of it anytime soon. He's just so good. And I started watching Uncle Buck. It was actually on regular TV last weekend,
I
caught
Buck.
Like the first half, 45 minutes or so. I got to watch the whole thing.
Is Uncle Buck before Home Alone?
I think it's after this. I think.
Yeah,
it's before Home Alone.
It's directly after this. Yeah, it's like 88. Yeah. Home Alone's like 1990.
Yeah, because yeah. Culkin has a really small part. Not small
yeah.
part.
Yeah.
But he's not as prominent in Uncle Buck as he is in Home Alone.
No, I mean, Home Alone's his
right,
movie.
Right, and he right. was fantastic. Yeah.
He's got the most screen time out of anyone.
Which is also funny because Catherine O'Hara's in that.
Right.
Another SCTV. Yeah.
And the scene in Uncle Buck when he gets called to the principal's office.
Oh, my God.
And he just dresses that horrible woman down yeah. and threatens her. And he walks into school and he's lighting a cigar, walking through school with his big coat on.
What do they
and
play, Wild like, Thing?
Nah, I own nah, everything.
Nah. And he just like wanders through the halls. Oh.
Throws her 50 cents. Go downtown and have a rat and all that thing off your face.
You guys saw Weird Science, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Remember the scene in the bar with the guys talking? I think I mentioned this in one of our other podcasts. And the guy's like, she kick you in the family jewels. The guy who has this like really raspy voice. So yeah. He is the voice of the rental car bus. The rental car funny. Bus driver, we tells him where the car
yeah.
is. Bus 7S. So what's the guy's name? Oh, wait, hold on a second. What's his name though? His name is Chino Fats Williams. Because it was bothering me. I'm like, it sounds like that guy. So I had to look it up. It was that guy.
Uncle Buck, that was a good one, too.
It's
like,
fun.
I would have been 11 years old when that came out. I just remember having such a crush on the daughter, who's like the teenager in that movie, the troublemaker.
She's a piece of work, right?
And another little side note I read that I just thought it was a nice touch was the ending of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles and the ending of Uncle Buck, they end exactly the same.
Really?
It's a freeze frame on John Candy doing a tight-lipped grin.
Oh, that's really funny.
Interesting.
That is so funny. Another episode we did on Stripes, and he's perfect in that. I mean, and it's we talked previous episode about which actually is dropping tomorrow is Fletch with Chevy Chase, and how Chevy has this ability to he's this leading man, but he can kind of do all these asides and throwaway lines that are hilarious. And it feels like he's making up a lot of them.
Right.
And that's the same with John Candy and Bill Murray to some extent too, that definitely Bill Murray, I guess, that they have the ability to be in the scene yet be able to ad lib the craziest lines, or at least it feels like they're ad libbing the lines and all that stuff that John Candy does in Stripes it feels like he's making it all up.
Well, they're all improv guys. I mean, that's what they're training. Right?
That's right. I saw this thing about Stripes that when they go to boot camp and they get their head shaved.
Right.
Everyone got their head shaved except Murray and Harold Ramis.
Right.
Because the studio didn't really want two leading men to have their head shaved. But everyone else, and they didn't know they were going to get their head shaved. So John Candy went in there thinking he's going to get his hair trimmed a little bit. They shaved his head, right? Or buzzed him down to a quarter inch and had no idea that was going to happen. So you saw their actual reactions. All these guys, ah, my hair, it's my real hair. And you get one shot at doing it, right? Uh-huh. That's it. He's a great actor. I truly miss him. I truly miss all these movies. And it feels good to go back and revisit a lot of this stuff again. It's just so.
Yeah, I'm watching it and I'm thinking like, oh man, if he was still around, you know, you just want to go back and just watch ever. He's just great.
Here in LA, we have this kind of weird connection with John Candy because he actually moved here and lived in LA at some point. Had his family here. And he was a friend of Wayne Gretzky's. And so when Wayne came to Los Angeles in the trade with Edmonton, all of a sudden Wayne brought all this Hollywood power to Kings games. And we had all these stars come to the Forum to watch Kings games, including John Candy. And John Candy becomes really close with Gretzky, and they bought the Toronto Argonauts.
Argonauts, that's right.
And he was a football player in high school, rips up his knee. He wanted to be a pro football player and never, you know, doesn't do that. So he goes into acting and comedy, and he has this, but he still has a sports connection, right? He wants to be an athlete in some way. So he becomes a owner of a football team.
And he gets in with that consortium and they bought the Honus Wagner baseball card.
That's right. Yeah. I think they sold it.
At one point in time, they owned the rarest baseball card there ever was.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. That's right. So what a great kind of revisit to a favorite actor, comedian, star, good all around guy, and a really great movie, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. And Dave, we cannot thank you enough for coming on and chatting about the movie and chatting all things Corby with us. This has been really fascinating and really fun.
Thank you guys for having me. This was amazing. It was a great way to spend an evening.
I'm glad. This was really fun.
On a Burns night, right?
On Burns night. That's right.
I thought of that today. I'm like, maybe I'm doing this. I guess it's not live, so it's fine. But
nope, it won't be out on Burns night. It'll be out in a couple of weeks. So, but this was great.
Yeah, and boy, this whiskey, you sent three really varied whiskeys, and they're all really good.
I love it.
I don't like Canadian whiskey.
So thank you to Dave Mitten, the global Canadian whiskey ambassador for Corby Wine and Spirit, for coming on tonight, chatting all things Canadian whiskey. And also, we have to remember, we had a special guest walk on earlier. This is Bob Hope, Joanne McGinnis, the whiskey lassie who came on.
Lola Falana. I like that.
She's like Dolores Hope.
Joey Heatherton. She's our Joey Heatherton.
Actually, Lola Heatherton, who was on SCTV. That's right. Joey Heatherton. And it was just a great way to spend an evening talking about John Candy and Steve Martin and John Hughes. And we'll drink one out to John Candy. And Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, a couple months after American Thanksgiving, an American Thanksgiving classic. Dave, thank you again for all the whiskeys that you sent us and just the whole evening. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me, guys.
Dave, cheers. You too.
Whatever.
Yeah, whatever. All right. Cheers, guys.
Cheers.
If you enjoy this show, please subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, Google, Audible, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. You can also find us on boozedancing.com. And if you have any questions, comments, show, or drink suggestions, email us at boozedancing@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.